There's no I in team, but there is one in Indeed, and that's the hiring platform that you need to build yours. When you're hiring, you need Indeed. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed's a powerful hiring platform that can help you do it all. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring all in one place so easy because Indeed does the hard work for you. They show you the candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your description immediately after you post so you can hire faster. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Offer good for a limited time. Claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. And support the show by saying that you heard it on this podcast. Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Back, everybody, to another episode of Benched with Bubba, episode 276. We have a recurring guest on the show, good friend of the show. You can find him on Twitter at @fantasy_esquire. His work over at pitcherlist.com. Dan Richards, how are we doing, my friend?
I'm good, man. I miss baseball, but I do appreciate you having me on, as always.
Yeah, no doubt about it. We all missed the game for sure, but we've been in touch over the last few weeks. You've had some awesome work come out over at Pitcher List. So, you know, we're going to talk about your last three articles, but anything you want to plug? I know as we record, there's like a half an hour left, and Pitcher List and Sleeper on the Bust are tied. So by the time we finish this, we'll know who's in the finals of the baseball pods.
Yeah, I don't usually participate in stuff like that, but I would like to see Pitcher List just, you know, Nick and Alex do such a great job, and John and Dave on the Hitter podcast too. And now they're doing this talking pitching thing where they're actually talking with Major League Baseball players, which I think is really cool. So it'd be great to see them and their efforts get rewarded and everything, you know?
Yeah, I'm with you. I absolutely love the talking pitching stuff, like the one they had this week with Lewis. That was awesome, just kind of getting the Aussie perspective on things. Like some of the things he was saying was hilarious. But the different guys they've had on, just the way that professional, like, you know, playing baseball or anything in life, you have a remembrance of, like, someone you care about, you really remember certain details of things. The way these pitchers can remember to a T, like, this guy hit a home run off of me like 6.5 years ago, and this was the 6 pitches I threw in this one at bat 7 years ago. Like, it's amazing what these guys remember.
I really liked Jameson Taillon's interview where he talked about how he game plans for a few hitters in every lineup and he doesn't for the others. And he just kind of, so for the like 6 hitters in the lineup, the normal hitters, he just tries to beat them with his best stuff. But then for 3 hitters, he knows that if his best stuff is a strength for them, he needs to go to something that's a weakness for him to exploit a weakness for them, because his strength against their strength is not always good enough, which I thought was really cool.
It is really cool to hear how they attack things like that, with Taillon talking about kind of giving us an even more idea. We kind of heard about it in early spring, but then hearing him talk about the different philosophy the Pirates are using. They're using technology, yeah, and pitching coaches. So that kind of gives us a little insight there. I love Trevor Mays. Like, it's hard not to like what May did there. It was just, he was so fun. And reliving that whole thing was great. Jeremy Blevins was a great one. They've all had phenomenal interviews. I can't wait to see who they keep coming up with down the pipeline. There's been a lot of fun. It's like, it's not super long, or 20 to 30 minutes, but you know, you can tell these guys enjoy just talking the craft and not having to talk about, you know, the million questions on what went wrong that night or something like that after a ball game. So it's pretty cool to listen to.
Yeah, some big names too. Jameson Taillon, Jesus Luzardo, like those are guys that we draft every year. Very good pitchers. It'll be exciting to see if they can get on going forward, because I imagine the more pitchers you have on, the easier it is to get the really big name guys, you know.
Agreed. A lot of them are all friends and they're all talking to each other, and it just takes one or two guys really enjoying it, going, yeah, these guys are cool, go chat with them for a little bit, it's fun, like they actually know what they're talking about, go have a good time. So I'm looking forward to it. But we're here to talk about your recent work here at Pitcher List, and you did a couple different articles on hitting. Like, we talk plate discipline a lot and how some guys are really good at it, some guys aren't, guys that have improved at it, so on and so forth. You did an article on patience at the plate and then aggressiveness at the plate. Let's start with your patience article. What were you trying to find out when you dug in on, you titled it, Is Patience a Virtue? What are you trying to figure out there?
So the first thing that got me going was going through Mike Trout's Fangraphs page. I think I was prompted by whether he is a Hall of Famer or by how much. And, I think it's obvious he is, but just I was kind of struck by the fact that his strikeout rate is pretty high, considering he's the best player in baseball. And you'd think that it would not be at a league average rate, but it is every year. And so that got me thinking, why? And does that matter less for him because for some reason he's able to compensate for that in other ways? And so one thing that stood out to me is that if you go to the Fangraphs leaderboards and sort by swing rate, he's typically on the low end, like top five or bottom five, if you want to look at it that way, in swing rate. And that's, I guess, an approach that works for him, even though he, strikes out quite a bit. He must be doing something else by being so patient, swinging at the right pitches. So from there, I wanted to see if just being patient in general is a good approach at the plate, because the best hitter in baseball is doing it. So I grabbed the 60 players with the lowest single season swing rates for 2017, 18, and 19. So a really low swing rate would be like 34%. And then I wanted to just basically compare them to how all the other hitters in MLB did throughout that time, and to see what makes, because not every single one of them was successful. And in fact, many of them weren't. And so what makes certain ones successful as opposed to others? And by success, I was measuring it in terms of batting average, because, I write about fantasy baseball. Mm-hmm. But basically, so the first interesting thing that I found was that these hitters tend to run very, very low swinging strike rates, but completely normal strikeout rates. So their average strikeout rate was comparable, about 19-20% to the MLB average, but their swinging strike rate was really low, 7.5% on average for these 60 single season players. The reason for that, I think, is because they swing so infrequently, they put few balls into play. So they also see more pitches, balls and called strikes. So they tend to have elevated walk rates as well. They average like a 13.5% walk rate versus the MLB average is around 9%. So they're putting fewer balls into play. They're walking more. They're striking out more. So if you were to say, hey, I might want to trade for, Daniel Vogelbach, because he has a very low swinging strike rate and his strikeout rate is kind of high. So like that's probably going to change in the future. You might want to think twice, because he doesn't swing very frequently. He sees so many called strikes that he underperforms his expected strikeout rate based on his swinging strike rate.
Hey, I got a couple of questions for you here, because you have the chart, the low swinging percent hitter averages, and you do the swinging percent, and there's the O swing, the zone swing, all that good stuff. Did you find any correlations? Because you're mainly using just overall swing percentage, right? Not like an O swing or a zone swing type situation when you're analyzing this.
Right. So to sort out so basically I compared hitters. I grabbed 60 single seasons from the last 3 years of the players with the lowest swing rates and compared, like grouped their stats together and compared that to the entirety of MLB throughout that time.
Gotcha. Because what I'm wondering, because you said the swing and strike rate's lower, but they strike out the same. I wonder if we looked at it more of almost do a CSW with these guys, called strikes and swinging strikes, and see how those correlate. together, because you'd have to imagine some of these guys that are super patient at the plate. It might be the old adage when we were growing up that, you know, take the first strike and stuff like that. And I wonder how many of these guys take a bunch of strikes compared to maybe guys that swing the bat more, if that makes any sense.
Right. And I think that's a good point. I think that their CSW rates would be relatively comparable to the rest of MLB, which is why their strikeout rates are basically the same. What we're not seeing when we look at their Fangraphs pages is we're not seeing a called strike rate, because it's just not something that they put on players' pages. So you see their swinging strike rate's really low, and you think, okay, maybe their strikeout rate's going to improve. Chances are it won't, just because they're taking so many called strikes. That's their approach at the plate, like Mike Trout, Reese Hoskins, and other patient hitters.
Yeah, no doubt about it. This is a really interesting thing to me, because we're going to get into your aggressive article, and it'll all kind of come together once we talk about both of them. So I don't want to try to ask too many questions out the gate, but it's really interesting to me, because we're in an era now where strikeouts are kind of not really, you know, frowned upon like they used to be back in the day. If you look at like the 90s and stuff, the way guys didn't strike out much, they hit for high average, all these different things. And then nowadays where it's flipped on the end, like a 250 average, you know, isn't great, but it's not like bad. Like it's acceptable if you're hitting, you know, 25, 30 plus home runs, and you're probably striking out 25% or more of the time. So it's just one of those things we see right now. And your chart shows pretty much all these guys, if they swing less compared to the MLB average, they're still pretty, you know, comparable, like you said, outside of swinging strike and walks. So that's pretty interesting looking at all that. What did you find when you broke it down even farther with these low swing hitters with the R2s and all that stuff?
Yeah, so in some ways they're comparable to – so basically what I did was I took these 60 hitters and I took their swing rates, O-swing, Z-swing, all the way down through their plate discipline metrics and their BABIPs as well. And I just looked at the correlation between those metrics for these hitters and their batting averages. And what I found was that, interestingly, Z contact percentage had a very high R squared with batting average. So in other words, if you take these 60 hitters and you say, who does well in batting average, like what explains the variation in the sample of the batting averages? Z contact explained quite a significant amount of variation relative to doing the same analysis, but for all MLB hitters. So Z contact rate matters a lot for these guys in determining who's going to have a high batting average if you're a patient hitter, and who's not going to have a high batting average if you're a patient hitter. And I think that a big part of that is, and also their swinging strike rates too, explained a really large part of it. But what's going on there, it goes back to the called strikes. So basically, if they're looking at too many called strikes, it's really important that when they do choose to swing, that they make contact on their swings in the zone, and that they make contact in general. So that's Z contact rate and swinging strike rate. So in other words, there are so few opportunities to put the ball in play because they swing so infrequently that they have to maximize those opportunities. And if they're not doing so, then they can wind up with a low batting average. So a fun example of that is Reese Hoskins, because in 2017, he had a very brief debut and he basically had a really low BABIP. He had a 241 BABIP and a 259 average, and he had a really low swinging strike rate, about 7%. And so if you're just looking at those things, you might think in 2018, well, you know, he could hit 270 or 280 because his BABIP could go up and he has such great plate discipline. But in reality, his BABIP did go up in 2018 and 19 to 270, and his batting average went down quite a bit to 246 and 226 in 18 and 19 respectively. And the reason for that is that his Z contact rate fell and his swinging strike rate fell. So even though his swing rate basically stayed the same, it went up a little bit, his other, like he remained a patient hitter and his BABIP improved, but he was not as discerning at the plate. He wasn't as properly selective with the pitches that he swung at, and so he made less contact in the zone and he made less contact in general, and that hurt his batting average quite a bit.
That's interesting, because Reese Hoskins is one of those guys that we're trying to kind of figure out what's going on, what went wrong, and maybe it's as simple as that, like you're pointing out. Let's just look at the basics here. You know, he's swinging at this, his zone contact's this, and you start piecing these things together, it makes a lot more sense than You know, he just wasn't hitting the ball hard, or he did a swing change, or these other things we're all trying to think of, which, you know, maybe has something to do with it, no doubt about it. But in the grand scheme of things, it could be something just like you're saying. Look at his zone contact going down, his swinging strike rate went up, and, you know, you just keep, you know, the numbers just keep kind of falling down as they go. It does stand out quite a bit. So when we're looking at these guys that are being patient at the plate, what's your overall conclusion of this? What can we utilize this for, say, from a fantasy perspective?
So if I'm looking to trade, say I am looking to trade for a hitter and I see that his swinging strike rate is very low, but his strikeout rate is average or pretty high, I want to look for his swing rate first. If his swing rate is low, then that means that regression probably isn't coming. If I'm befuddled as to why, you know, I own a player and his batting average isn't getting better, and he's a patient hitter, then I should look at his Z contact rate and I should look at his swinging strike rate, because if he, like, you have to have an elite swinging strike rate to be a successful patient hitter, really elite. Like, we're talking like 6%, like Mike Trout levels, you know, Joey Votto levels, better than what Rhys Hoskins was doing, to maintain a high batting average. Because if you don't, there are just so few opportunities to hit the ball and put it in play if you're only swinging a third of the time. And another thing I'd look at is their BABIP. You know, like BABIP, if you look at the table in my article, BABIP was just as, if not slightly more important for determining which of these 60 hitters would have a high batting average as it is for the whole of the league. So, again, like Mike Trout has a much better batted ball profile than Rhys Hoskins does. And so he's more likely to run a 300 or higher BABIP, and he's more likely to have an average, a higher average. And that goes for any player, but it especially matters for these players.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to look at it because, you know, I said a second ago, when we're trying to figure out, you know, maybe guys to break out and other things, like on Baseball Savant, for instance, I will kind of look at the, you know, zone contact, zone swings, all these different aspects of it, but it doesn't always have like the swinging strikes like you have on Fangraphs and some of the other things that you were utilizing. So one of these days we'll have it all in one spot. But for now,
yeah,
we got to keep piecing it all together, and it's cool to have articles like this to kind of help point it out. And the following week or so, you came out with "Does it pay to be aggressive?" For me, it was kind of a offset of, you know, we had a patience article. Now let's look at these aggressive hitters. What did you find with guys with high swing percentages?
Yeah, so I did the exact same thing. I took the 60 single season highest swing rates back through 2017. And I just took the averages of their play discipline metrics. And what stood out to me was that these hitters did better in terms of batting average and BABIP on average than the MLB average. They did worse in swinging strike rate, but they actually did better in strikeout rate. So we sort of had the inverse of what was going on before, and they had very low walk rates. And one thing that I found was interesting was that even though their batting averages were better, and that's important for fantasy baseball, they had a very low average WRC plus of just 105 relative to the 2017 to 19 average of 112. And that's not the actual average of all hitters through those years, just the qualified hitters on Fangraphs. But qualified hitters did better than these 60 aggressive hitters did in terms of WRC plus. But just going back to the swinging strike rate, I think it's important because, again, you have a scenario where you might look at the swinging strike rate and expect one thing and get another. And it's just the inverse of what was going on with the patient hitters. These guys swing so much, they put so many balls into play that they see fewer called strikes, and therefore their swinging strike rates matter less to their strikeout rates because they have fewer opportunities to strike out. And the same thing for walks. They walk less because they don't get into deep counts as often because they put the ball into play often because they swing a lot.
Yeah, no, it's definitely I'm kind of leaning towards like the new era, like I was saying a little bit ago, is kind of the higher swing percentage guys, more aggressive in the box type situation. It's interesting to me. It's like when you had your low swing chart, now you have your high swing chart, and there are a lot of similarities. And you're like you did say, like, the obviously the walks are different because they're not going to walk as much and they're putting the ball in play so much. The BABIP will be a little higher, as you'd expect. The batting average is higher as well. But you know, like your WRC plus is higher for the guys that are a little more patient. It's an interesting, I guess, conundrum between the two when you look at it all. When you dug even deeper on this aggressiveness, you have the benefits from aggression. What are some of the things you saw? Like, what benefits did you see from guys being much more aggressive in the box?
I mean, I think that you kind of hit the nail on the head before. These hitters can maintain higher batting averages, and it's sort of like the new wave of hitting where they just sort of swing at everything. And that's what got me on this in the first place is, you know, how does a guy like Javi Baez or Tim Anderson, you know, these guys with like 17% swinging strike rates, how do these guys hit 280 or Tim Anderson win a batting title? Like, it's just strange. And I think a few years ago, we probably would have scoffed at them and just said, they're not repeating that. But now we kind of look a little deeper into it. And in terms of the benefits and just, you know, the correlations, the one thing about aggressive hitting is that the plate discipline metrics basically didn't matter. So when we isolate the 60 players and we say who had a better batting average and what explained that batting average relative to the other 59 hitters in the sample, BABIP accounted for a huge amount of that variation, more than if you took the whole sample of MLB players and said what accounts for the variation in their batting average, in their batting averages. So BABIP accounted for about 70% of the variation among these 60 hitters' batting averages, and that's really the key. So, you know, if you have a player like Jeff McNeil who's swinging 60% of the time, if he's putting the ball in play a lot, it really, really, really matters if he's able to get on base when he puts the ball in play, for his batting average, that is.
Yeah, it's kind of the old philosophy, you know, put the ball in play and make these guys make a play. Don't help them out by, you know, taking strikes or, you know, walking's fine to get on base, but the more you put the ball in play, the more you put pressure on a defense to make a play. As simple as it might seem, as you field the ball, you throw the ball, you catch the ball, that's three things they got to do correct to get you out. Or if you just put the ball in play, you never know. Things can happen. I know when we talked to John Metzler with his ideal contact rate, there's all different ways to analyze quality of contact. And I think a lot of that kind of contact, you can kind of use that metric and then go with this aggressive hitter idea. And he's like the swinging strike and those situations, swinging percentage and whatnot, and kind of get an idea. You know, this guy swings a lot. He's got an ideal contact rate. Here we go. So I think there's a lot of ways to correlate these two things together. One thing you have here is the zone swing percentage has a pretty high relation to batting average compared to just the average MLB player. It's not like as high as BABIP, obviously, but it's a high outlier in the scenario. I think it's very interesting because it goes back to the patience thing. It's one thing I talk about with Kevin Biggio quite a bit. It's if he was just more aggressive, because he's got a high strikeout rate, phenomenal OBP guy, but the average just isn't there. It's like he's too patient. He's too patient at the plate. You see these aggressive guys, sure, they might, you know, swing a little more outside the zone and whatnot, but they're also swinging much more often in the zone. So I think that's a tremendous thing. Obviously, you were saying this, but I'm just kind of reiterating it. This is one thing I'm curious to get your opinion on, because like I was looking at Domingo Santana the other day and some other kind of deeper guys looking for value, looking for guys that might improve on the years past, or, hey, what went wrong type situations. And you look at their zone swing, zone contact, their O swing, O contact. You look at some of these things, and some guys are really good. Like, you know, you were talking Javi Baez. How does he make such good, like, do so well when he swings out of the zone so much? Well, he's aggressive and he takes advantage of it. Have you, maybe you haven't looked at it yet, maybe this is a very long-winded, diluted question, but have you looked at maybe guys that have improved just their contact on, you know, contact and their swing? Because some guys will still swing a lot and not make contact, if this makes any sense. Have you looked into something similar in that direction at all?
So you mean where they improve, an aggressive hitter who 1 year was bad, but the next year was good because he was able to make more contact?
Yeah, is that like, I know it's probably not like sticky, but, you know, there's so many years where I'd be like, I'm not buying into Javi Baez. You look at his profile, he swings so much out of the zone, like you can't stay like that successful, and he keeps doing it. Have we found something? And he's just the easiest example, but there's a lot of guys nowadays that are just being aggressive like that. Have you noticed anything like that?
So one thing that I would say is that when we evaluate a hitter's batting average, and we're just talking about batting average, we're not talking about whether they're, you know, good overall hitter. We shouldn't look too much at O swing rate, like how much they swing out of the zone. That actually has a very high correlation with walk rate, but it has very little to do with batting average. Because basically it's just whether you're swinging at pitches that would otherwise walk you. And so if you look at the chart, in my article, there's a correlation for, basically I have the R squared for O swing rate to the 60 hitters batting averages, and it's zero. And I have the same thing for the entire sample of MLB hitters, and it's 0.01. So in other words, swinging outside of the zone is not a good measure of whether or not a hitter will have a good or a bad batting average. But what I will say is that if you want to discern between aggressive hitters who will have high batting averages and aggressive hitters who will not have high batting averages, bearing in mind that on average, these hitters do better in batting average than the rest of the league, the best place to look is their BABIP, because the BABIP matters more for these hitters than other hitters. So if you want to, if let's say, well, actually Tim Anderson is a great example where he had a pretty mediocre batting average the last couple of years, but in 2019, he was the batting champion in the American League. And so if you look at, I would assume, and actually I'm going to look right now, but I would assume that that's almost entirely BABIP driven, because he's so aggressive. He puts the ball in play a ton. If his balls in play are falling in for hits, he's going to have a high batting average. And if not, he won't. And his strikeout rate has very little to do with basically his batting average. And lo and behold, his BABIP in 2017 was 328. In 2018, it was 289. And last year, it was 399. So the example that I use in the article is Eddie Rosario and Jeff McNeil, because they both had two of the highest swing rates in baseball at all in the last 3 years, about 60%. They both had very high swinging strike rates. They both had low strikeout rates. They had very similar plate discipline. The only thing is McNeil had over a 300 batting average. And I'm talking about 2019. McNeil had a very good batting average, and Rosario had a mediocre batting average because McNeil had a much better BABIP, because he puts a lot of line drives into play, because he puts a lot of ground balls into play, whereas Rosario pulls a lot of fly balls, basically. And so that's really for these types of hitters, you know, you're really aggressive, like your Mondesi types. What matters most is whether they have a batted ball profile that lends itself to a high batting average, to a high batted.
And I like this discussion, because and that's why I'm just kind of taking it down random ways to see where we can keep going with it. Because,
yeah,
you know, we look at, like I said, the modern day of baseball, where I when I analyze hitters, I look at like a 250 average, and I'm not turned off like a lot of people are. Like, I get it. You're going to have to draft some guys with better batting average on your team, but you'll listen to some analysts and they'll be like, nope, not even going to mess with this guy because it's a bad batting average. But, you know, you look at season's end in a fantasy league, what's 270-ish going to finish you at least in the top half of a roto league, if not higher, in just that category. So, you know, you don't need a big gap like you used to. You don't have to hit 290 or something. It's a big difference nowadays. So I think when people point at guys that strike out a lot, they kind of turn it off. And you mentioned Tim Anderson, and this is a really fun one for me, because a guy I was torn on so much early in the season, and one, I guess, you know, I look for any caveat of a delayed season as being a good thing. It's helped me dig in on players more, and I'm really learned to buy in on Keston Hira. And one of the biggest arguments for Hira is he struck out almost 31% of the time last year. He struck out over 26% of the time in AAA, but he had a 402 BABIP. So it's one of those things, like you said, sure, maybe he's striking out a ton, but he's still being very aggressive. His BABIP's through the roof. That's why he still hit 303. He hits the ball hard, still almost hit 20 homers. You look at his BABIP throughout the minors, outside of one season, they were basically 386 or higher every season. Thus, in all of those seasons, he hit 320 or higher everywhere he went except 303 with the Brewers. Like, the dude is, I think, a pretty good hitter. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just using it as a talking point here. I think like the Tim Anderson argument and some of these, this can be used to actually maybe benefit the cause for Keston Hira, unless I'm totally misinterpreting this.
No, I think that's right. It really just depends. Like, I haven't taken the time to look at, you know, what's Keston Hira's line drive rate? What's his fly ball rate, ground ball rate? You know, what's his batted ball profile? And would it lend itself to a high BABIP? I do see the 402 BABIP. There are instances where a hitter runs a very high BABIP, and this is sort of how we were thinking in 2016 and 17 when we first started you know, well, maybe not all of us, but when I first started looking into peripheral statistics and advanced baseball metrics. But, you know, the way I thought about it was, if you have a BABIP that high, it has to go down. And not necessarily. And sometimes, though, it does. And so a good example of that is like Chris Bryant, where his BABIP was pretty high last year, but he had a very low expected batting average on StatCast because his batted ball profile does not lend itself to a high BABIP. And so he basically got pretty lucky in hitting 280 or whatever he did last year. But I really like the first point that you made, which was that, you know, it doesn't really matter. Strikeout rate doesn't really matter. If you strike out a lot, it doesn't make you a bad player. So just now I went to the FanGraphs leaderboard. I downloaded the qualified hitters for 2019. And I ran a regression between WRC plus and strikeout rate. And lo and behold, there's a 2.2% or even less correlation. I mean, it's just strikeout rate has very little influence on WRC plus. WRC plus is a measure of overall offensive performance. So you're right in a sense that being a high strikeout hitter is not necessarily detrimental, and not at all. It's just not borne out in the numbers.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to ask you your opinion on that, because you know as well as I do that was like that's been a massive bugaboo even until now. Like, people say if you strike out a lot, you're just like a not disciplined, not good hitter, and like this production is not like sustainable. And we're learning that it is, and that's why I wanted to have this discussion with you, because I've said it a few times on the show already, and anyone that's listened to my show enough knows for years I was the anti-Javi Baez guy. I wanted nothing to do with a guy that just, to me, undisciplined at the plate. I just wanted nothing to do with that. But as time goes on, you have to adjust as the game adjusts. And I had him everywhere this year, it seemed like. A, because I thought he was a value. B, I started to believe what he's doing. It's the way he plays baseball. Baseball's changed. He's changed. Like, that's the way the game is changing. We're striking out more. That's just the way it's going to work. So I'm actually going to make notes to dig in on this more. Now I'm like super intrigued just in this discussion we had. Because like I said, Keston here is one guy I've done a complete 180 on. I wanted nothing to do with him. And the more I've looked, the more I've learned that, okay, go ahead, strike out 25 to 30%. I'll live with that as long as you're still hitting I'll even take a 280 to 300 average because I believe the power and the hit profiles there. I'm really curious to see who else I can find digging in on this some more. What would be your final thoughts on just if you want to kind of combine your patience and your aggressive, are you going to do any more work on this? How are you going to utilize these for your fantasy, you know, teams? What's the overall consensus of these two pieces?
One thing that I do want to look at is whether having a high stringing, you know, what makes some of these guys with high swing strike rates specifically good hitters in terms of batting average, like what separates them from other hitters with high swinging strike rates who have terrible batting averages. I would be curious to dig into that. And I do think it's probably BABIP related. But I think it's interesting. Takeaways are few and far between. I don't think you can say that. I think you can say that on average, aggressive hitters are not better MLB hitters than the rest of the league. In terms of WRC plus, that's at least borne out. But patience, I think, can be a virtue if you're the type of hitter who can, you know, really maximize your swings. And aggressiveness can work to your advantage in terms of batting average if you have a good batted ball profile. And I also wanted to add, I'm just looking at Keston Hura right now. I see a 266 expected batting average with, and this is just from 2019, obviously, but he has a far below average ground ball rate in terms of StatCast. He has a very high fly ball rate. So those are two bad things for BABIP. But he also has a high line drive rate, a low pop-up rate, and he pulls the ball infrequently. So those are three good things for BABIP. So I could see maybe I don't see him hitting, you know, 300 again, but he could definitely hit like 280, like you're saying, and meet somewhere in the middle with his expected batting average, because maybe he is just one of those guys that, you know, swings a lot, puts the ball in play a lot. I mean, his swing percentage is really high. It's 51%. But yeah.
Yeah, he's an interesting one too. Like, if you go to FanGraphs, like, I usually like to use the metrics like on Savant, like you're using right now, but they don't have the minor league numbers. And if you like, you look at his ground ball, fly ball, all those things on FanGraphs, they're almost like I within a couple percentage points. He's been that type of hitter his whole way. It's another way for me to be like, okay, this is something he does. Like, it's just who he is, because he's always been a great hitter. He's a great hitter in the college. That's why he went high in the draft. It's been his defense. It's the biggest bugaboo for all these years. So he just really, he intrigues me. Like, he's one of those guys, I don't know why. Now I spent too much time. He should have had a season a month ago. Like, I've spent too much time on Keston Hiura. But it's interesting to check out. And I want to see more, and this will just take more deep diving, and I'm not saying by you, just in general. I want to see how kind of the fluctuation is. Maybe, you know, year two, 1 year, a guy, maybe a 20% swing, he jumps to like, it's rare to see a massive jump, but say he jumps like 30% and then he goes back to 20% and he fluctuates a lot. Is there any way to find consistency with guessing his production, I guess, type thing? Because usually, you know, a guy's either disciplined or he's not. But every now and then you see a guy change the way he approaches the plate. So I'm curious to see how that kind of predictive model can be made there as well. But things to think about, that's for sure. All right, let's get into your pitching piece. And this one really intrigues me. I think it's great because one thing you do and a lot of the guys at Pitcher List do very, very well is you break things down for everybody and then you expand on them. And that's something you did in this pitcher piece, which is great because – I've been doing this for a while, and I still kind of get torn on different things. I know Nick talks about it on the podcast with Alex a lot. He looked like the Sierra and all those things. He loves Sierra, but there's FIP, there's XFIP, there's XERA, there's Sierra, there's all these things. This is your second time doing an article. Like, you're expanding on a previous article that you've done. But first off, you have the glossary on all the things you did here. What are you trying to explain in this article to add on to your previous one?
So, and thank you for that lovely intro. A year ago, I wrote about ERA indicators, so FIP, XFIP, and Sierra, and basically, because I had been using them without regard for much understanding of them, I wanted to not only expand my own understanding, but give people a sense of why you would use one over another, why you would use them at all. And so I took 2017 and 18 numbers, and I just wanted to see, you know, which one of the three correlates best to ERA and which one of the three was most predictive of ERA in the following season. And so what I found then was that XFIP and Sierra were more predictive of, none of them were very predictive at all, but those two were more predictive of ERA in 2018. So XFIP and Sierra in 2017 were more predictive of ERA in 2018 than FIP or ERA itself, and FIP was highly correlated with ERA in the same single season. So this time, what I wanted to do was expand the sample, because that's obviously a pretty small sample of pitchers. So took data with the help of Tim Ricker at Pitcher List, who's a great data scientist. We found data going back to 2015, all the way through to 2019. And the first thing we did was we looked at the single season correlations to see what was most highly correlated with ERA in the same season. And then the second thing we did was we did back-to-back seasons. And we said, what for those 4 or 5 years, which ERA indicator was most predictive of ERA in the second year. And we also added in XERA, which is StatCast's new ERA indicator. We wanted to see how that stacked up to the other ones.
No, I love it because, you know, a lot of people think XFIP's the cat's meow. FIP's obviously there. I know, I think I remember correctly that Alex and Nick like Sierra quite a bit. They like that. I think XERA is great because we're in this era of X stats. We just talked about Keston Hiura's X batting average, X slug, and we use them all the time because obviously they've been proven to be pretty solid predictive measures. Like, they're not sticky like a barrel is, but they're pretty confident year in and year out, like a guy underperformed or overperformed. At least gives you an idea of what you're looking at. Right. And I think XERA does that well. I don't know if you looked at Alex Chamberlain's pitch leaderboard, but he has one that really gets my attention. He has deserved ERA, which is similar to XERA. I'm not sure exactly to what ratio those are, but he has one that really gets my attention. And I know it needs, he says he's even working on it some more. It's called What If ERA. And it's basically usually lower. It takes out a couple of factors that really just give you the brass tacks of, you know, this guy got hit really hard or he didn't, is what it comes down to. And it's really intriguing to me. But, you know, with the bouncy ball, what can we, is that a usable stat? Who knows? But when you looked at the correlations here, obviously a couple of them are pretty lightly lined up, pretty similar. One stands out a little more than the other. What were you finding by looking at FIP, XFIP, Sierra, and XERA? We're looking at ERA, a stat that we still use in roto leagues and head-to-heads, but in reality, when we're analyzing pitchers, really doesn't matter as much as we think it used to.
So we had about 700. So we did the innings pitched cutoff at 100 innings. So we would basically only get starting pitchers. And we had about 700 seasons between 2015 and 19 with 100 innings pitched. And we found that basically FIP is your best in-season correlation to ERA, slightly edging out XERA. Both were pretty good, and XFIP and Sierra were not great. And basically what that means is that so the R-squared for FIP was 0.61, right? That means that 61% of the variance in those 700 ERAs can be explained by a pitcher's FIP, FIP being his strikeout rate, home run rate, or his strikeouts, home runs, and walks, because FIP totally ignores balls in play. And so what you can use FIP for, and XERA is pretty similar, it's at 0.58, the R-squared, you can use those two metrics and say it's May 1st and you want to see if, you know, in a normal year where there's no coronavirus, and you want to see in the last, you know, 40 or so days, my pitcher has a 1.50 ERA. Is that going, like, did he earn that? Was that luck? If his FIP is 4.2, then, you know, it probably was quite a bit of luck and batted ball dependent, if anything, because his strikeouts, walks, and home runs would tell you that he did not earn his 1.5 ERA. And XERA is very similar. It can tell you whether the pitcher earned his ERA. It just uses balls in play. It doesn't completely ignore balls in play, but it uses launch angle and exit velocity averages and says, okay, he gave up this launch angle and exit velocity on this hit. On average, that would result in this many runs, and that's how you get results for XERA's batted ball. And so those two metrics are great for seeing if a guy got lucky or not in a single season.
No, that's really interesting to me, because the way they correlate this way, I know FIP is 61%, like you said, XERA is 58. If I'm going to put you on the spot here, if you had to use just one, which one would you prefer to use?
Well, I would use FIP just because the R-squared was higher. So okay. FIP did a better job. It was more highly correlated with ERA in those seasons than XERA. But I think that it's probably helpful to check one against the other, you know?
So this was for in season, as you're saying. What did you find out when you looked at, you know, future seasons and stuff like that with these metrics? Because, you know, right now, and we've done all off season, we're trying to predict what the player is going to do in 2020. So we're looking at last year's stats. What are you using
exactly
in that case to figure it out?
Yeah, and this is the time where you would want to use the ones that do the best looking forward, not in season, the ones that do the best looking backward. And so, you know, again, we had the same sample of pitchers, but this time there were only 354 that had back-to-back 100 innings pitched seasons that we could use. And so basically, we used the root mean squared error, which is a great measure to determine predictiveness, because it's scaled to the measure you're using. So say root mean squared error of, let's take ERA, for example. If we're looking at this sample of 350 pitchers, if the root mean squared error from their ERAs in year one is 1.113, as it was that we found, to their year two ERA, that means that on average, the model built by the year one ERAs had an error of about 1.113 runs. And so, you know, if a guy had an ERA of 3 in 2019, and you want to know what his ERA is going to be in 2020, if you just look at his ERA of 3, it's got a pretty big error to or measure of degree of error relative to what it actually will be in 2020, at least on average. So we did that for ERA, XFIP, FIP, Sierra, and XERA. And basically, Sierra and XFIP had the lowest root mean squared error, which is a good thing because you want the average error for your model to be low relative to your actual observed values. And so basically, Sierra was slightly better than XFIP with 0.871 root mean squared error. But still, that's a pretty big average error. Like if he had a 3 ERA in a 3 Sierra in 2019, he could have, if you're just looking at Sierra, he could have a 3.871, you know, ERA in 2020 based on his 2019 Sierra. Like that's the degree of error there. So none of these metrics are great, but Sierra was the best. And one thing that we found that was really interesting was that actually strikeout minus walk rate had a better root mean squared error and R squared to second season ERA than any of these ERA indicators. So if you find an equation, which we did and we put it in the article, for predicted ERA based on 2019 or the year before's, you can do this for any season, the year before's strikeout minus walk rate, you're more likely to get an accurate ERA for the following season than if you used xERA, Sierra, xFIP, FIP, or ERA.
I know a lot of people like to use K to walk rate, as you're mentioning. It's interesting that this panned out to be such a great stat for this scenario here. A lot of people, a lot of really good pitching gurus like to use K to walk rate to kind of look at how a pitcher's improved from point A to point B type situations. Is there any, I don't know the right word to say, why would you think that this comes out to be such a good indicator of ERA? Because some guys just strike out a ton of guys and don't walk any, but still give up a lot of runs. I get it. If you're striking out more than you walk, there's less guys on base and you get more outs. I understand that aspect of it. But I just wondering, what's your thoughts on maybe why this one stood out over the rest?
I would guess that strikeout minus walk rate is just a great indicator of dominance because it penalizes the pitcher for walks and it rewards the pitcher for strikeouts. And you know, if a pitcher is giving up a lot of balls in play or home runs, but more, let's just stick to balls in play, then he can get burned pretty easily. But and that'll change year to year. So it's much harder for him to control his ERA year to year. Whereas if he's more reliant on strikeouts, the ball never goes into play, he gets the out. So I think that, you know, basically it just speaks to how, like, we were right with our intuition with FIP, you know, 20 years ago or whatever, when it first came out, that balls in play and home runs, although home runs are included in FIP, that balls in play and home runs in general are just fickle. They, you know, they change quite a bit for each pitcher year to year. They're often based on luck. And therefore, I mean, there's some skill in how you manage contact, but for sure, strikeout minus walk rate is more predictive because it in and of itself is a sticky skill. Like your pitcher's walk rate, a pitcher's strikeout rate, those things stabilize after quite a bit of time. So it's a nice measure of ERA in a future season.
See, Dan's a nice guy. Dan could have said, "Bubba, it's obvious why Kato walks." but he explained it nicely, like he does. Like it could have been like, "Bubba, come on, think a little bit here." But another question I want to ask you is by looking at this. I find it interesting. It makes sense to me, but maybe you could explain the correlation between the two stats that make them similar. But when we did the end season, FIP and xERA were kind of close and the two best. When we go to the next season, they're identical, but like the two low ones. Can you explain to the listeners why maybe FIP and xERA seem to stick together so much?
My guess is that, well, first of all, obviously both account for walk and strikeout rate. And the only difference between the two of them is how they account for balls in play. My guess would be that the reason is that basically by taking the averages of a pitcher's balls allowed in play, which is what xERA does, by taking total averages and applying them to the actual hits allowed, you're going to get a pretty similar result if you just completely ignore them as well. I mean, I haven't done any analysis to prove or disprove that, but that might be one reason why, maybe just pitchers on average give up similar contact across the board to some degree. And so therefore, if you're just giving them averages, you might as well just ignore them too. I mean, it almost makes very little difference because all of their balls in play are similar to other pitchers anyway. That said, one thing I did want to add was that we actually looked into DRA, which is Baseball Prospectus's ERA indicator. We didn't add it to the article because we did it afterward, but I will add that for the DRA in year one to ERA in year two, the R squared was 0.135. So it is about as good as a predictor for future performance as FIP and XERA, just like we were talking about. Not as good as XFIP or Sierra or strikeout minus walk rate.
I smell a third article coming up in the pipeline for you on this topic. Just a hunch. It sounds like it's coming. But it's very interesting to see how this all goes because we're all looking for the next way to kind of figure out how good a guy is and how to predict how good they're going to be next year without, you know, using the great resources like ATC and Steamer to do it for us. It's nice to be able to kind of look at numbers and maybe not make a full set of projections for every player, but give a good argument of why this guy's going to be better or not the next year. So it's fun to talk about this kind of stuff. Before we wrap up, I have to ask you, because I've pestered you in DMs before. I've read your articles and quoted them in my written pieces many times. And I know we've talked about it multiple times on my show because you've made a few articles on it. What's the latest and greatest? Because I know your mind is always racing, maybe not on this subject per se, but I'd imagine you've thought of things here and there on your ballpark factors, your barrel per ballpark factors. I know you've done a couple articles on that. Alex Fass has done something similar, but you guys have some great work on that. So what's kind of the latest and greatest on that? Or are we just kind of sitting back and relaxing for now and sitting pretty with what we got?
Yeah, so I wrote a few articles on ballpark factors a couple months ago, like maybe in December, in January. And so I looked at, you know, creating ballpark factors based on barrels for hitters. So where's the best place to have your barrels converted into home runs and which directions in those places as well. And then I did the same thing for hitters, but not using barrel rate. Instead, using WOBA minus X WOBA, I think, or X WOBA minus WOBA. Now I can't remember, but basically looking at outcomes versus actual outcomes versus deserved outcomes, and where because those are graded on run expectancy scale, so they're good for pitchers, like good measures for pitchers. I don't have anything in the works in that regard. We did Tim and I incorporate these park factors into the next iteration of predicted home runs. And basically I am ready, willing, and able to write an update to predicted home runs, which is much, it's overdue. We're just waiting on a couple technical things because we really want to get it on. I don't know if you've noticed, but PitcherList has a leaderboard now where you can see stats. And so we want to get it up there too. And so once we can figure out the technical issues and get it on the leaderboard, then we're going to update and publish the new iteration of predicted home runs. So, I mean, that would be most useful in a season where they're not talking about players playing in Arizona, because, you know, we have their ballpark factors incorporated into our predictions for their home runs. But it is what it is. It'll be more useful the following season, I guess.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to ask you. I wasn't trying to put pressure on you, but I'm thoroughly like intrigued by the articles you have coming out. Max Fries has had some good stuff on park factors, because it's not just the simple, you know, you go to ESPN or FanGraphs or any of them who've done their work for it, but it just kind of spits out a number, and this is what, like, it's like you rank like based on that number who's good and bad. Like, you actually, right, you guys break it down to lefties, righties, versus lefties, righties, ballparks, barrels, non-barrels. Like, you take it to the whole level of, you know, if someone goes to the Baseball Savant page and then has your page next to it or your chart next to it, they can really sit there and go, okay, this guy's going to flourish here. Because, you know, like right now, I'm a part of a group of 30 guys that are doing that. We're recreating baseball, basically. We're doing OOTP, and I'm the Giants, and we're all taking turns in a snake draft building a new baseball team. And as people that played OOTP, it takes into the defenses, bark factors, all those things. So you build your team a little different than you would for fantasy baseball. So I would be lying if I haven't said that I've looked at your articles in the last few days to kind of, because I already kind of knew how the Giants stadium operates, you know, don't hit the ball to pitcher the triples alley. I get it. But, you know, righties actually can hit home runs there, people. It's possible. You'd be surprised.
Yep.
But you can see it in your article. So I want to say thank you. And that's why I wanted to ask, because I've said it about many guys at Pitcher List, and I've said it on the show a lot. I love having you guys on the show because you guys do great work. You guys make it so idiots like me can understand it and learn from it. And it's stuff that I could never put on paper, but I love reading. So I wanted to ask you and say thank you for doing all that.
Yeah, man, anytime. How's your team coming out, by the way?
How is my team coming out? If you give me great radio here for 30 seconds, I will pull up the roster. It's a slow draft, and it's the definition of slow at times. But again, 30 teams.
Let me just get on my soapbox here. People who take the full 4 hours or whatever to slow draft, they irk the hell out of me. I mean, I really I do not have patience to sit there and wait 3 hours and 59 minutes to make my pick, you know? And I don't understand, you can get updates to your phone, whatever. I probably just lost half your audience getting pissed off at me, but tell me about your team.
So like I said, it's 30 picks around snake draft. So we're in round 11 right now. So it's taken a long time, but it's a lot of picks. And it gets deep because you're doing different strategies. It's not like going off a regular ADP, but I got Scherzer. I got Keston Hira because I think he actually flourished in that ballpark. I got Starling Marte, Zach Wheeler, who I think it would be amazing in that ballpark. Scott Kingery, Dansby Swanson, Adrian Hauser, and his sinker is going to be beautiful. Mauricio Dubon, Jared Kelenic, Jason Castro with his just skills behind the plate. And then I got Hansel Robles as my first reliever. So it's all over the board because we're going so deep. But it's I'm intrigued so far. And it's a lot of versatility with my bats. Like, none of them are scary power hitters, but it's Oracle ballpark.
Right. Yeah. You wouldn't want to build a team around that in that ballpark. And is this like a dynasty format young players?
What it is it's OTP. So it factors in their age, their propensity to get injured, all these different factors. So these young guys will keep getting better. We're going to sim the next 3 seasons. Every 2 weeks of the sim, we can make roster moves, trades, whatever we want to do. It's a 50-man rosters because we're not going to make adds and drops. So it's you load your team up, and then you rock and roll. So it's an interesting format. It's a way to pass the time. So and still think about baseball, but think about it in kind of a fantasy perspective and kind of a little different. So it's kind of fun getting different reactions on Twitter. Hey, why'd you take this guy? And I kind of explain a little bit that, you know, I'm a big Scott Kingery fan, but I kind of like him even more in AT&T Park because he can play three or four positions. He can enjoy the gaps with a little bit of power. He's got some speed. I kind of like that about him. So we'll see.
Right. Yeah, I like your team. I also think that's a great idea. I kind of wish I participated in that or knew about it before, but very jealous. That'll be a lot of fun.
Well, if you're really interested in it, stay on the phone after we finish this, and I will have a surprise for you. So
there you go.
But right before we wrap it up here, why don't you remind everybody where they can find you and, you know, plug away, maybe something coming up, your stuff we already talked about, whatever you want. Floor is yours.
Cool, man. Yeah, I don't have that many plans to, articles on the rise, and I will, of course, continue to publish and write. But you can follow me on Twitter at @fantasy_esquire. And, if you want to just see my snark or whatever. And I hope that the Pitcher List podcast moves on in the bracket. And Bubba, I have to thank you for having me on again. This was a lot of fun.
No problem. I always love talking to you, Dan. It's a blast. And just for people that maybe are listening for tonight or tomorrow morning, Pitcher List did advance. They are in the championship. So I just saw the tweet. They are in the championship.
Wow.
Barely edged out Sleeper in the Bust. So it has happened. But everybody can go check out Dan on Twitter at @fantasy_esquire. We'll be back with you next week with more fantasy baseball action. But for now, Bench with Bubba, episode 276 in the books. Catch you guys later.
Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.